I'm not afraid of losing my job, but I am afraid that my country will fail. I'm afraid patriots of this country have died in vain. I'm afraid my children won't grow up in a free country. I'm afraid injustice will prevail. But truth sets us free from fear.
You're hearing right there from U.S. Congresswoman Jamie Herrera Butler from Washington State's 3rd Congressional District, one of a group of 10 Republicans in the House who joined Democrats to impeach Donald Trump. So what's the Senate's next move? What sort of inauguration are we in for? The nation and the world holding its breath. And we are too at Seattle News Views and Brews, your coffee break political podcast. Brian Callinan here. I'm a host on Seattle Channel. The views expressed here are my own. And joining me is the indefatigable Kevin Schofield of Seattle City Council Insight. You are worth 6 syllables and a lot more, Kevin. How you doing, man?
I'm good. I'm glad you're here because there's no way I would be able to get that word out of my mouth.
You got to pause before it. That's the whole trick to it.
Okay.
Many thanks also to City Grind Espresso in the coveted role of background noise sponsor for the audio podcast. It's the coffee stand on the first floor of City Hall. Closed, of course, during the COVID crisis, but their Henry Art Gallery location is open. Open for takeout there. Help them out. Thanks also to our patrons on Patreon. Matt, thank you for coming on board this week. Thanks also to Zach for increasing his support for the program. And thanks especially to the patrons who responded, yes, we want a Seattle News, Views, and Brews coffee mug. That's Arushi, Rob, Zach, Sergey, Joan. That's my mom. She wants two. They're going to get mugs next month. If you want in, pledge at the $10 level and we will hook you up. Thanks especially to all of our patrons for helping us out here. And I am hoping that more of you can join us and support local independent journalism. Very important to us. Finally, thank you to Converge Media. Converge airs the video version of our podcast on their YouTube channel Wednesday nights at 6 o'clock. All right, let's do this right here, right now. Kevin, it really seems like we are seeing history being rewritten every week here. And it's never happened before. And here we go. A second impeachment against a president, Donald Trump. Two Washington GOP reps voted in favor of this. Jamie Herrera Butler from the 3rd District in Southwest Washington. Dan Newhouse from the 4th in Central Washington. They are part of a group of 10 Republicans who support impeachment. That might not sound like much, but it's the most members of a president's party to vote for his impeachment in U.S. history. Kevin, I just wanted to talk about this part to start. What struck you about that turn for the GOP in the House? Does it open the door for more political cover in the Senate? Or what do you think happens next?
Yeah, I think the GOP are clearly wrestling with what to do about Trump going forward.
Yeah.
Right. And they, you know, they embraced him for the, you know, political power with the base that he gave them.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's certainly, you know, I think we've heard some comments, you know, from Mitch McConnell, you know, explicitly and through the, you know, background channel, saying that he's really seeing this as potentially an opportunity to rid the party of Donald Trump, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, he and there's always this kind of backstabbing in political parties and
sure,
in politics, right? You know, he has become the most powerful person in the Republican Party.
Yeah, Trump
and,
has. Yeah.
You know, and he's certainly not the only one who aspires to be the most powerful person in the Republican Party.
Right.
So to think that there wasn't going to be other politicians who look for the opportunity to dethrone Trump was silly. Of course, this was going to happen.
Right.
And Trump is probably the weakest he's been since he first went down that escalator.
Right now. Yeah, so they're looking for some different ways here. But in looking at this, McConnell, I know he says he's not calling the Senate back early, so this sets the stage potentially for an impeachment after Trump has left office. So some interesting questions with this one, constitutionally at least. Can the Senate do something like this? They did in 1797 with Senator William Blount, and in 1876 with Secretary of War William Belknap. You will be hearing those names over the next couple of weeks here. But this impeachment requires a two-thirds vote of the Senate. And Kevin, I'm looking at this. The focus may turn from this, and just hear me out here, it may turn from this to the idea of barring Trump from public office again. So Section 3 of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, and here we go. That section prevents people from holding federal office if they've engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the Constitution. Only requires a majority vote of both houses here. Kevin, I know I went into a lot of different legal issues there, but do you think this might be a path forward for these Republicans who are looking to gather some support for this potentially?
Well, that doesn't even require the Republicans, right?
Right,
because,
right, yeah.
Because after January 20th or whenever the Georgia election is certified, there will be a majority in both houses. Right. Democrats could do that on their own.
Sure.
But, you know, there will be some Republicans who, you know, want to banish Trump who do that. But, you know, there's other consequences too, right?
Sure.
Trump gets $1 million travel budget a year as an ex-president, right?
Yep.
He gets Secret Service for life.
Following around the rest of his life, right.
There are all sorts of benefits that he, you know, a pension, right?
Yeah.
A federal pension, right?
Yep.
All that would go away potentially if the Senate votes to convict, right?
Yeah.
So will they vote to convict with a two-thirds majority? I think it's unlikely.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're just going to have to see how the next few weeks play out.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It may be right that the Republicans do, once Trump is out of D.C., that they really do band together and say, this is our chance to get rid of the guy.
And try to rewrite some of the history for the Republican Party. I mean, you could call it the party of Trump right now. And I think a lot of Republicans are buckling at that.
We haven't seen the other shoe drop on the insurrection stuff.
True. More details still coming out about that.
There's a lot of FBI investigations still going on and still ramping up around that. And what, you know, still to be investigated is, was there a role of any Republican members of Congress in helping get, you know, that insurrection set up? There's been, you know, several reports that there are Republican members of Congress who actually toured around some of the leaders of the various sort of far-right movements that participated in the Proud Boys and QAnon and all that around the Capitol in the couple of days before, you know, last Wednesday.
Sure.
So, you know, are any of them, you know, involved in this, right?
Well,
and, you know, because they could get easily sort of removed from Congress. Congress could, you know, choose to unseat them, and they could actually face, you know, federal charges.
Right.
Criminal charges if that happens. So, there is a lot to still play out now in understanding, you know, really how far and how deep this goes.
Yeah. So many of those stories from the insurrection still coming out, these terrible stories of officers on the ground being beaten, take his gun and shoot him with it. I mean, things like that. It's incredible. But I did want to bring it back to the local level because security is ramping up at our state capitals too. The FBI warning of armed protests leading up to the inauguration. I know that last week, President Trump sent out a message that urged no violence or law breaking. Take that for what you will. Kevin, is it time to brace ourselves? What do you expect in the days leading up to that in our state, the inauguration here?
Well, I think it's hard to say. You know, everybody's on guard now. Right?
Yeah, so that's for sure.
National Guards are you know, ramping up across all 50 states.
Yeah.
You know, not all the states have, you know, their legislatures in session. But, you know, state capitals are going to be, you know, on guard next Wednesday when the impeachment happens. Certainly Washington, D.C. is getting locked down.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's going to be a very, very different impeachment with Washington, D.C. locked down.
Yeah.
And, you know, will there be people trying stuff?
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Will it amount to anything?
I think. Yeah.
You know,
I think a lot of people are on guard. That's for sure. Yeah.
People are on guard. And you know, no, at this point, after, you know, the U.S. Capitol Guard being, you know, no pun intended, caught off guard.
Yeah. Embarrassed.
Last week.
Yeah.
Nobody else is going to get caught off guard.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
If they're going to err, they're going to err on the side of being overprepared for it.
Fair enough. I wanted to make sure we got back to the Seattle City Council. Not too much exciting stuff on the agenda this week. To all those floodplain ordinance fans out there, I'm very sorry, but we're going to have to move on here. Kevin, the council is working on its crowd control policies, though, behind the scenes right now for the police department. You wrote a piece about this on Seattle City Council Insight. So just some history here. Back in June, protesting in Seattle, you will remember, getting very hot around some different BLM issues. The council pushed through a number of changes, an almost complete ban on tear gas, rubber bullets, etc. They did that very quickly. A few weeks later, the federal judge overseeing the consent decree process threw out those changes, said the council didn't go through the proper channels, and they also might endanger public safety if cops only have batons and guns. Concerned about that. After that, the Office of Police Accountability, the OPA, the Office of Inspector General, OIG, and the Community Police Commission, which is getting some new members this week, reviewed those policies and offered some recommendations. That's the backstory. Kevin, what's the council going to do here? What's happening?
Well, yeah. So they're taking those recommendations from the OPA, the Inspector General, and the CPC.
Yeah.
We need a better name. Maybe we should just call it Triumvirate or something.
Right. Big three.
The Police Accountability Triumvirate gave the recommendations in August. Councilmember Herbold, who chairs the City Council's Public Safety Committee, is taking all that, and she's kind of laid it all out in a nice little chart that shows where the three are in consensus and where they're not. And then she's written a draft bill with changes to their original ban on crowd control weapons that already incorporates the places where there's consensus and kind of leaves as open questions for the moment. Where there's differences of opinion.
Sure.
And she's had two committee meetings already just to discuss
right.
the consensus and the differences, get it out on the table. In the meeting last week, some of the other council members on her committee got a chance to sort of weigh in with kind of what they think about the places where there's still differences. And the strongest statement they all made was there seems to be strong consensus among the city council that blast balls should be banned altogether. And that was something that CPC has said for years that they should be banned. But the Inspector General and the OPA had not come down on that side.
Right, right. And we've seen so much activity over the past few months here of officers throwing them overhand. I mean, not using them as they're intended to be used, maybe using them in situations where people haven't even provoked them. That's a big concern here.
Right. So, and they're going to have, it's not so clear cut on some of the other kinds of weapons, flashbangs and 40 millimeter launchers for foam tip bullets and things like that.
Yeah.
So what they're going to do is they're going to come back on January 26th.
Yeah.
They're going to try with hopefully formal amendments to kind of really vote on what do we want to put in this bill for each of these.
Yeah.
They're going to vote it out of committee. And then before it comes to the full council for final approval, they're going to do what they're supposed to do under the consent decree, which is send it to the DOJ and the police monitor, get their feedback on it, maybe do another round within committee to incorporate any feedback from that. Send it to Judge Robart once there is sort of consensus with them. Get his approval, and once he approves it, bring it back to the full council for final adoption.
And that
could take minimally several weeks and probably months to go through.
And I was going to say, with regard to the Police Officers Guild, that's still a piece of this too. How does that piece get involved?
That is right. So under state law and under the SPOG contract, the city has a responsibility to appropriately provision officers with equipment that they need.
Right.
And if this ban that the city council puts in place leaves them without appropriate weapons for certain situations, then that is going to be the whole question of what is appropriate equipment to be issuing to them is absolutely going to be an issue for collective bargaining, right? And so that's going to implicate the SPOG contract. And the police department, the police officers, frontline officers are working without a contract at the moment.
That's right.
Expired at the
end of last year.
December 31st.
Yep.
So, so there are contract negotiations coming up and they're going to be very, very messy. And on one hand, this is certainly something that's going to make it even messier to have to deal with this in the middle of that as well, with the city council pushing forward. And by the way, SPD, as we talked about before, is also pushing
doing its
forward
own process,
its
yeah.
own set of recommendations for these same crowd control and use of force policies.
Right.
And they're going to finish up at the end of January as well.
Yeah.
And so, and they're going to, send that over to the DOJ and the police monitor. So the DOJ and the police monitor are going to have these two things, and they're going to go, okay, well, how do we reconcile these? And what is it should we pick one? Should we try to merge them together and give sort of combined feedback to to SPD and the city council? Say, guys, get your act together. Like, bring us back one thing.
Sure, sure.
Because we don't want to be the mediators between different parts of city government. It's going to be really weird.
All right. Well, let me make it even weirder, because we're talking about some stuff happening at the state level with these issues, too. That's in our next segment. Now hear this. So a group of mayors labor leaders, community leaders, headed down to Olympia last week to testify about changing some state laws on how police officers are disciplined, among other concerns here. Consider this, an officer fired by his or her chief for severe misconduct. Well, a study in the Washington Post shows about one out of four of those officers get back on the job through arbitration appeals from their police unions. Mayor Jenny Durkan is concerned about this when the decision of a chief regarding discipline gets reversed. Here's what she said.
It is very unsettling to community and to officers if the decisions of a sheriff and chief can be overturned by an arbitrator without good cause. We need more certainty in that process.
This is a big story here, Kevin. And police unions, I know, especially in Seattle, are not all that popular with our elected leaders right now. They're not all that popular with the King County Labor Council, for that matter. But is there enough momentum at the state level to change or eliminate this arbitration process for officers in these discipline cases? What do you think?
It's really hard to say.
Yeah.
This is a politically very diverse state.
And yeah.
Where in, we have tunnel vision in Seattle, It looks like police officers and police guilds are not very popular at all.
Yeah.
But certainly in Eastern Washington and really even the kind of more rural areas of even King County, they're a lot more popular, right? Not entirely, but we've seen, in the fall election with issues around King County Sheriff, there's room for reform everywhere, and people
of course,
see
that
there's room for reform everywhere. But there are lots of communities that really like their police officers. So it's not clear, at the statewide level how much support for these kinds of reforms can be. But on the arbitration appeal stuff,
yes,
we have to remember here in Seattle, this was one of the reasons why the Judge Robart found the city out of compliance. Right.
That's right.
Specifically the case of Officer Adley Shepard.
Yeah.
Who. Punched a handcuffed
woman in the face, suspect
mm-hmm. in the face when she tried to kick him from the back of his police car,
mm-hmm.
and he was terminated for that.
That's right.
And an outside third party arbitrator reversed that.
Yep.
And had him reinstated.
Yeah.
And Judge Robart looked at that and said, yeah, clearly this police accountability system is not working.
Yeah.
That is the outcome.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, there's certainly good arguments along that line. That's one of the reasons that Mayor Durkan showed up in Olympia last week to talk about this.
Is
because from the city's point of view, there have to be changes here, right? They can't get to a police accountability system that will make the judge happy,
right?
And make our own citizens happy, as long as some of these issues around arbitration, still exist.
Yeah, and we're going to be talking about what's going on at the state level in the weeks ahead, but just a little bit more closely on what's happening with the police union here in Seattle, SPOG. As it turns out, two Seattle police officers have now been placed on administrative leave. They were in Washington, D.C. during the riot at the Capitol January 6th, a riot that involved the death of a police officer there. Seattle Police Chief Adrian Diaz says if those officers were involved somehow in the insurrection, he will fire them. But then we've got some pushback from Seattle Police Officer Guild President Mike Solon. Solon actually tweeted at one point, "The far left and far right are responsible for that sad day." A number of people called on him to resign, the mayor among them, most of the council, but he says he's not budging. Kevin, I'm just thinking about this at the local level with this state action that's going on. What's the state of labor relations with SPOG right now, which is working on this expired contract?
Oh, it's bad. It's terrible, right? And Mike Solon is the guy out in front, and it's not clear whether he's going to be actually sitting at the table during the negotiations. But at the end of the day, he's going to be the one making a recommendation to own members as to whether they should vote for whatever contract that's eventually gets negotiated on. This,
right.
And he is absolutely taking a hardline approach to this. But he was clear that he was going to take a hardline approach when he ran for SPOG president and they elected him anyway. So this is really, this shouldn't be any surprise to the officers of SPOG. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was a year ago. He took office last February.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of water under the bridge since then. So I wonder whether SPD officers are thinking a little differently about it now. They may be. They may not be. They may be even further entrenched where they are. I think we're going to have to see That, what I'm hearing in the background is there have not really been any calls from within SP and within SPOG to, you know, take another look at whether Mike Sullivan should be president. Yeah. But, you know, there may be other shoes to fall, you know, and this one as well. There have been recent reports that, you know, and this is, you know, continuing sort of this whole list of circumstantial evidence around these things.
Sure.
Mike Sullivan had a Parler account.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, nobody's yet, because Parler is still shut down, nobody's really sort of come up with, you know, a list of like, what are the things that he was posting up on Parler and how inflammatory was it? But, you know, it may show that, you know, he's got connections to, you know, other for, you know, we don't know to the extent to which Mike Sullivan may be deeply involved in far right movements. Right. Yeah. And that may, you know, be something that pushes SPD officers to want to disassociate from him. Right.
Yeah, it was.
It's he certainly would not be alone being a police officer either in Seattle or, you know, in Washington State or in the country who has far right connections. Right.
Yeah.
There are many of them. I don't want to say most of them. I don't want to try to characterize
how
broad that is.
Yeah.
But there are certainly police officers and law enforcement officials in this country that have far right, you know, organization connections. Right?
Yeah.
And that's an issue that's going to have to be dealt with as we move forward and look at other kind of insurrectionist movements.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting to see the Fraternal Order of Police in our state speak out against Mike Sullivan in this case, too. So a lot still ahead with that one for sure. But I did want to move on to the story that really underlies every story we do right now, Kevin, which is COVID and what's happening with it. We're watching a process right now as Seattle and King County are ramping up COVID vaccinations. King County wants to open two mega vaccination stations by the start of February. Seattle has firefighters going door to door to help vaccinate at adult family homes for people who aren't covered in the federal vaccination program. Kevin, we're starting to see this effort ramp up. What impact do you think it's going to have?
Well, I think it's going to help us in the short term really get to get through and vaccinate the highest priority categories right now.
Right.
And a lot of that is, you know, frontline medical workers, healthcare workers, and the most vulnerable people in our society, in our city, including the people, you know, the federal government is trying to take care of people living in long-term homes, long-term care facilities. But there are also a lot of elderly people in these adult family homes, which are small, you know, 3 to 8 people, you know, between staff and residents living in these places.
Smaller
health conditions, so elderly, they are absolutely the most vulnerable.
Yeah.
And I think if we can effectively do that, we will see the mortality rate from COVID drop substantially in our community.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm hoping so too. Are we going to get to that 70% magical number for herd immunity in terms of people getting vaccinated?
Long way away.
I feel the same.
Right?
Yeah.
So at this point, first priority is really let's cut the people who, you know, like healthcare workers, frontline workers that we know, you know, can be vectors for spreading this thing.
Right.
Get them vaccinated.
Yeah.
And get the mortality rate down.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
That's a really, really good start while we wait for production of vaccines to continue to ramp up.
Yep, yep. And we'll see what happens here. It looks like Johnson & Johnson a little bit slower. They've got the one-shot solution here for COVID. So we'll see how that one rolls out. And I should point out, I'm covering a lot of these issues in a story you will find on Seattle Channel, City Inside Out, with people from state, county health, also international community health services too. A lot of complexity to the story, so make sure you check it out. I'm going to move on to our final segment, What's Next? Kevin, if Kermit the Frog were here, he'd probably tell us at this point, it's not easy being green. But the city of Seattle is sure trying here. The mayor and council member Mosqueda writing to the city's pension fund last week, asking them to divest from fossil fuel investments. This is a request that has been attempted and has failed before. And I should point out, in the land use committee, Kevin, you've been tracking some possible changes to the energy code to ban gas-powered electric resistance heat and water heating for commercial and residential buildings starting next year. A lot happening here with this green movement. What's going on?
Yeah, so you know, with the energy code stuff, the city is looking. You may remember last year they actually. I'm sorry. Yeah, last year Mayor Durkan issued an executive order banning gas hookups for new city buildings,
new construction.
Right?
So,
and a couple of years ago, former city council member Mike O'Brien started pushing really hard for banning gas hookups to all new buildings in Seattle. That didn't go anywhere.
No.
But this is sort of, a step in that direction with an update to the construction and energy codes that would ban gas for heat and water heat in commercial buildings.
Yes.
And in multifamily residential buildings.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Particularly ones where there's central heat and central water heating.
Yeah. Yeah. The goal here, I should point out, the city's trying to get carbon neutral by the year 2050, but keep going, Kevin. Yeah.
Yeah. So interestingly enough, you know, some of the more kind of marginal parts of it in past attempts at this were things that, like, well, what about cook stoves?
Right. Yeah.
And particularly for commercial buildings where they're, where there may be restaurants.
Sure.
You know,
right.
Or other, commercial cooking.
Aren't they using a lot of fuel? Yeah. It turns out. Yeah.
And, while induction stoves are moving along, they're not there yet. And
right.
They're certainly not there for residential buildings.
Yeah. 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 Right?
So, that's not included in this. There's what they're proposing right now will not ban gas cooktops, but it does require that there be an electrical connection behind the cooktop, so that, you know, in the future,
when
everything's ready, they can easily just pull out the gas cooktop and drop in an electrical induction one.
Well, it was interesting to me, Kevin, to really look at kind of the makeup of how we use power in our city. And it really appeared that how we heat up our spaces, how we heat up our water, that makes up the vast bulk of the power that we're using here, the energy that we're using here. 88%, if I was looking at the graphs right there. Yeah. I mean, that's really where the city wants to target its efforts right now, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah. And that will just make a huge, huge difference if we can get there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're going to finish up our awesome podcast here with the critical matter of what's going to go with your coffee on your coffee break. Kevin knows his baking. I know a lot about eating, as it turns out. Today, may I present to you, Kevin, the orange poppy seed biscotti my daughter cooked.
Tried biscotti.
This is the stuff, man. And I got to tell you, a little orange zest going on there, some poppy seed. I don't have a drug test coming up, so I'm all about it. But it's something about the crispness of it, but not too crisp. Do you have a secret on biscotti here? Because you always have good answer to these queries.
Yeah, so biscotti literally means baked twice. Mm. They're fun and interesting to bake. I don't know if you watch your daughter make them.
Yes. But,
So you make the dough, you bake it for a little while, pull it out, slice it up, lay it on the side, and then you bake it, and you bake it at a low temperature. Basically, you're really just trying to dry it out.
Yes, yes.
Right, not trying to like really bake it or brown it or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's actually not that hard. people get scared about biscotti. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are a couple of ways you can screw up, but it's just not that hard, and it's fun.
Yeah.
And it's nice to make biscotti. It's almost harder to get like if you want to like do the chocolate dip or something like
yes,
that.
Yes,
chocolate turns out to be way harder to work with than the biscotti.
Yeah.
You just try it a couple times and you get
right. Familiar. Yeah. Got to get some different desired crispnesses is one issue.
And everybody, everybody has, their favorite level of crispness. Some people like the tooth breaking kind of hardness. There are people who really like it. Well, and there are usually people who end up dipping them in their coffee. Or
right. That, which you can do. Very important.
Which you can certainly do that. I like it, sort of much more on the softer side. Mm. Not so soft that it's like chewy, but sort of crisp, but kind of falls apart pretty quickly.
Indeed. Well, Kevin, I thank you as always for the great knowledge about baking and all things in public affairs, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
All righty. Remember, everybody, if you want to support us on Patreon at the $10 a month level, you can get your very own Seattle News, Views, and Brews coffee mug. Kevin can't wait for his. I just put in the order. I promise I did. It's coming soon.
I want the mug.
I know. Well, get it for you. I'll get it for you. I promise. And thanks, everybody, for checking in here to Seattle News, Views, and Brews, where you can always find out what's brewing in local politics. Subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And please do support us on Patreon if you like what you're hearing. We do need your help to keep this operation going. Thank you, as always, for listening. Thanks for watching on Converge Media 2. We will see you next time. Seattle News, Views, and Brews is an independent production of Callinan Media Services. Copyright 2021.